My castaway this week is a surgeon. Born in Egypt 60 years ago, he's recognised as one of the great pioneers of heart transplant surgery in this country. It's a position that has not been achieved without enormous controversy. Some of his experiments, such as when he kept a child alive by connecting him to a baboon, provoked public outcry. But these days, his heart transplant operations enjoy a 90% success rate. If you don't want to do anything experimental, he said, you don't want to do anything new. You have to keep exploring the limits. He is Sir Magdi Yacoub. You could almost say these days, Professor Yacoub, that heart transplants are routine. Does that mean that, in a sense, you've stopped exploring the limits?
Not at all, although there has been a lot of improvements and achievements in the transplantation field. There are still a lot of problems and a lot of areas which need to be explored, which are currently being explored. Problems like what we call chronic rejection, and that the hearts develop a degree of coronary disease. So there is narrowing of the coronaries again. There are tumors, there could be cancer, there are rejection, infections. All right, it's not very common, but it needs to be eradicated.
So when it's said that you have a 90% success rate, what does that mean?
The 90% is in a subset of patients who have ideal characteristics. Sicker patients have anything like 80% or sometimes even 70%.
But what does that mean? That
means that at the end of 1 year, 80 to 90% of the patients are alive, but they have a 5-year chance of survival of something like 65% and a 10-year of around 55%.
Is there an age limit? Is there an age after which you would not give someone a transplant?
The problem is the availability of donor organs and the competition between people on the waiting list, and the age plays a very major role, because you will always tend to give the heart to a younger individual. So we say that it is not practical now to accept people over the age of 60 or 65 sometimes, unless they are in a very good shape and they are going to improve dramatically to make use of this very, very rare resource.
Let's just pause there for a moment and tell me about the first record that you'd like to take to this desert island.
I would like to take Book One from the Well-Tempered Clavier by Johann Sebastian Bach. I find the music of Bach very, very soothing. It sounds very, very simple, and yet it's absolutely perfect in every way, mathematically, the structure, the way he puts it together in a simple and masterly way.
Prelude and Fugue Number 1 from Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier, played by Sviatoslav Richter. Do you play music in the operating theatre, Professor Yacoub?
Yes, we do. I find that very soothing, and it stops people talking, which I can't stand, at least talking irrelevances, and that sort of creates an atmosphere of concentration.
So you like silence. You're not someone who, as you say, talks throughout an operation or likes to...
No, I adore silence. I find it a bliss.
We were talking about your patients. You have one, of course, Derek Morris, who's Britain's longest surviving heart transplant patient. I think 15 years ago now you gave him a new heart, didn't you?
Yes, I think 14, 15 years.
Mm. And he obviously is important to you, but he was even so at the time because he, I think, was your third transplant operation and the first two had died.
That's correct. Derek is very important for more than one reason, because he is an ideal patient in more than one way, because he sort of very meticulous and has made use of the operation, if you like, of the improvement in that he continued to do his own thing. He has carried on to do his job. He is a sort of a model patient which people look at and sort of admire.
It does seem to me, reading about you, that you go out of your way to learn about your patients, to find out what makes them tick, to tell them to take a holiday, to tell you about their problems.
I try. I don't always succeed because of limitations of time sometimes, but I try and I love it. It is important to have that rapport, and that could help the patient physically. By having a positive attitude, for example. That sometimes is a very important factor which can help the patient recover.
There have been other stories, too, of your giving your own blood to a patient during the course of an operation or sitting next to a baby struggling for life in an incubator and, again, giving your blood. Those are true, those stories, are they?
Yeah, I don't think that is anything unusual, because I think giving blood is a duty almost.
But inevitably, I think you will agree, you've been criticised for it. Your colleagues feel that you're crossing the line, you're becoming emotionally involved with your patients.
Maybe that is true, but I think while a doctor should be rational and detached in some way to be able to do absolutely the right thing at the right time, you cannot deny the fact that everybody is not a machine, and you cannot suddenly say, I don't have any emotions and I'm going to be a machine. So a mixture of the two, I don't think, does any harm.
Tell me about your second record.
The second record is by Bob Marley. No Woman, No Cry is one of my favourites. I didn't understand Bob Marley initially. And it was my son who was playing Bob Marley, and it took me some time to understand this music. And then when I did, I found that he's an extremely sensitive person with lovely music, which tackles a lot of human issues.
Bob Marley and No Woman, No Cry. Can you trace the origin of your ambitions to be a heart surgeon, Professor Yacoub? Was there a moment in your early life when you said, that's what I'm going to be?
Almost as far as I remember, I wanted to be a doctor. My father was a doctor, and I identified a lot with him. And I said almost jokingly that I'm going to be a surgeon, probably a heart surgeon or a brain surgeon, and my father opposed me and said, you'll never make that. It's not a very good life, you can see it, how I'm struggling all the time. And B, you almost certainly are not suited for it.
And then his sister, your aunt, died when you were quite young, didn't she? And that had quite a profound effect on you.
Yes, his younger sister, who was at the time 22, died during childbirth from a narrowing of one of the heart valves, the mitral valve, an eminently correctable condition.
Correctable even then?
Even then, there were a few people who would open that valve and cure the condition.
So was that the point, really, at which you thought, this is what I'm going to do?
I think that was another factor which sort of strengthened my resolve.
This was all in Egypt. You lived outside Cairo, what's some?
Yes, we lived in many parts of Egypt because my father had to go wherever there was a need for a surgeon, whether it's in a small town in the south or in Cairo or in some of the villages and so on.
But eventually, after you'd studied at Cairo University, you came to Britain to work, didn't you? Early 60s, I think it was. And obviously, those were the years leading up to the point when Christian Barnard in 1967 was to perform the world's first heart transplant. Was there an air of anticipation of that? Was it an exciting time? Did you feel in the heart field that something was going to happen?
Yes, indeed. I think transplantation of the heart is an idea, and like many ideas, they just mature. But it was exciting all the same to know that it has now entered the clinical arena, that you can do it in people.
And did that make you even more determined that you were going to do it too?
Yes, indeed.
Tell me about record number three.
Record number three is from Mozart's Requiem, the Confitantes. The whole of the Requiem, Mozart's Requiem, is wonderful. It's an incredible piece of music. It's perfection again. And the Confitantes representing this terrific agitation of the soul or something, which only Mozart can depict with such brilliance.
Part of the Confutatis from Mozart's Requiem with the Vienna Philharmonic and State Opera Chorus, conducted by István Kertész. You came back, Magda Yacoub, from Chicago in 1969 to this country and to Harefield Hospital in Middlesex, where you've been ever since. But you came presumably then because it gave you license to run your own show. You could set up a transplant program and do it how you wanted to do it.
I came back for a variety of reasons. One is what you say, is to run a show, and again, transplantation was not the only thing. There was other things like with pediatrics and other types of heart surgery, but also because of identify very strongly with the concept of the NHS. I think it's a marvelous system. Yes, it has a lot of problems and deficiencies which need to be corrected, that's for sure. It's not perfect, but what is? But it is the nearest you can get to perfection. Sometimes I think the British public don't realize what an asset this is and how important it is to preserve it, strengthen it, and get it to a very high level.
Do you think it's being preserved and strengthened at the moment?
I don't know. I think that there are attempts at strengthening it, but there are some negative forces as well, and hopefully the good will win.
It must, though, going back to the 70s now, it must have been quite a blow for you. Nevertheless, and I'm sorry to harp on about transplants, but obviously this was the dramatic end of your business. Because suddenly in 1973, the Department of Health banned them, didn't it? It said they couldn't happen. And indeed, they remained banned for 6 years.
Yes, indeed. That happened because there is an opportunity to force an issue, to say that this is something which can be done and should be done. But then many people do it without preparing, like what happened in many centres. The results were less than optimal, and that created a bad atmosphere.
Do you think you were partly to blame for that atmosphere and that ban? Because in 1973, you operated without much warning, didn't you, on a patient, and gave him a new heart? And
yes, you could say that, but it is these attempts which forced the pace and have made people think harder and try harder to develop new drugs, new knowledge.
But at the time, the result of, I mean, of course, as you say, that's what experimentation does. But at the time, what it forced was a ban on the work that you so desperately wanted to do. That must have been very frustrating for you, those 6 years.
Yes. On the other hand, I had so many other things to be worrying about at the time. So I waited for the opportunity to come back into that field, and that happened.
6 years later, as we shall hear. But tell me about your next record first, number four.
That also comes from Mozart's Requiem, and it is the Lacrimosa, which follows immediately after the previous piece of music and provides a contrast, because this is a very peaceful, thoughtful piece of music.
Part of the Lacrimosa from Mozart's Requiem, again with the Vienna Philharmonic and State Opera Chorus, conducted by István Kertész. You hit the headlines on several occasions during that period in the 70s, during the ban, Magda Yacoub. Once when you connected a child, a 13-month-old, I think, to a live baboon. Can you explain what you did and why you did it?
At that time, it was shown by some investigators that if you cool a primate, specifically the baboon, and then exchange, take all his blood out and put human blood, and then rewarm that animal, that animal would live happily. The blood will not reject the other organs and vice versa. This will continue for a period of several weeks. During that period, you can connect that animal to a human where the blood is compatible. If you do that, you provide a multi-organ support. This has been done to provide support for failing livers. What I did was just an extension of that concept, because I had this beautiful baby who had one-chambered heart, had some sort of a correction and was doing well, and then the heart failed, but also several other organs failed. His brain, however, did not, and that was a very strong stimulus for me to think that if I connect that baby to a baboon treated in the fashion I've just mentioned, that can provide multi-organ support.
So the baboon is effectively a living heart, lungs and kidney machine?
Heart, kidney, liver, everything, yeah.
Sedated, lying alongside the child?
Yes.
And fulfilling all the organic functions?
Correct. And the jaundice disappeared, the heart of the baby improved for a period of time, all the organs, the kidneys of the child started to work.
So scientifically, it was completely sound. What about ethically? Did you have any ethical dilemma about that?
Yes, I felt at the time, and I feel now, that there are certain animals who are breeding too fast, and the baboon comes under that heading, because there are too many. There's no way we can use an animal who threatened like the higher primates. But baboons, I thought that they can be used on one condition, and that is that we should respect their needs.
But as I understand your position as far as the child, the human being, is concerned, and your position applies across the board, is very straightforward. If there's a chance of saving a life, it's perfectly proper to do so as long as it doesn't put another life in danger.
Correct.
Now, what about in the case which occurred, I think, in the mid-80s, when you used the heart from a baby born with a malformed brain, and you transplanted it into a baby with a heart defect? There was a lot of controversy over that, wasn't there? I mean, it was said that you kept alive the donor baby in order to take its heart.
Correct.
And I think it was a police investigation in the end, wasn't there?
Correct. I mean, it started anyway, yeah. Yeah, the problem
is...
very
emotive stuff.
It is indeed, but it depends what you mean by alive. If I lose my brain or I'm born without it, I'm not alive. I don't think you can say that baby was alive. It's the word alive.
Of course, the baby connected to the baboon died in the end, didn't he?
Yes, indeed.
And the baboon died too, poisoned by the baby.
The baboon, yeah, but it wasn't inevitable that either the baboon or the baby will die. I mean, if this is to be repeated 100 times, I'm sure you'll get away with it in 80-90%.
And you'd do the same thing again tomorrow?
I think I would do the same again tomorrow. I didn't expect the outcry which happened afterwards, and I would still defend that action.
Next piece of music.
The next piece of music is The Dance of the Swans from Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake. Tchaikovsky is, again, a very sensitive musician, and he created this music with 3 or 4 dancers dancing, and that, to me, represents human elegance in a very big way.
The Dance of the Swans from Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake with the Vienna Philharmonic, conducted by James Levine. You've tried very hard, Professor Yacoub, during the course of all of this pioneering work, to keep a low profile yourself on the personal level, which hasn't been easy because, as we've discussed, it's all been so controversial. Why are you so shy about having a public profile?
What I feel is that the issues which are being addressed at any one time can be confused with the people who are involved.
You also prefer to get on with your work, I presume.
That's right.
Not to be interviewed all the time. But you accepted a knighthood a few years ago, and obviously your work has brought you material rewards. Fast Italian cars, I'm told, at which you fall asleep at the wheel, is that right? And houses abroad and so on. Do you have time to enjoy all of these things, or are you always working?
No, I try and balance my life as much as possible, but sometimes it's difficult.
You still make appointments, I understand, to see patients at 2 o'clock in the morning, because that's the only time you've got free.
Sometimes, yeah. And not often, I hope.
But, I mean, you come here today having performed an operation in the early hours of the morning, because yours is simply an unpredictable profession, obviously.
Yes, indeed.
And how do you cope with that? I mean, do you manage to live a healthy life nevertheless?
My wife is very strict about that. She tries very hard to make me do all the right things and to swim and every morning and to walk and to do this. And I object sometimes, but I end up enjoying it.
But do you drink? Do you smoke?
I drink socially. I don't smoke. I did or sometimes even now, smoke a pipe every now and then, but hardly.
And I also understand that when you go on holiday, you don't fully relax because you're constantly ringing up to find out how your patients are doing.
Yeah, but that's the way of life. You tend to accept and live with it.
You're said to be unflappable. Do you think you are?
I try to. I'm not sure how successful I am, but I try.
You have an inner calm.
Yes, I again try and make it a real thing. It's not always infallible.
But that's why you find silence bliss and why you like very precise and mathematical music, is it? You like a sense of order, or you try to bring a sense of order into yourself.
And maybe that's the case, yes.
Next piece of music.
The next piece of music is from St. Matthew Passion, and it is the last chorus translated into English. It is, "With tears of grief we leave you, dear." And I've listened to it many times before, but on one occasion in a local church when I heard my own daughter singing in the choir, I was so moved that that piece of music has just stuck in my mind and will forever.
Final chorus from Bach's St. Matthew Passion, Wir setzen uns mit Tränen nieder, with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra and Chorus, conducted by Sir George Scholte. How far off, Professor Yacoub, do you think the invention of the artificial heart is, of something small enough and powerful enough, as the heart is, to pump blood around the body for 24 hours a day?
There are devices now which can support life for up to 1 or 2 years. And that period could be lengthened. It hasn't got the finesse of a biological system, which is just incredible. It's so superior to anything man can make. But the interesting thing is that now, with the aid of molecular biology, you can control biological processes, or you can have a hybrid whereby you have genes doing things for you in an artificial fashion, if you like. And perhaps also what is coming is manipulating organs from other species to make them compatible with man.
So if man can't invent the heart, a heart himself, he can actually find a way around it, you think?
Correct, correct.
Record number 7.
I would like to take with me Schubert's Serenade. A lot of Schubert's music is very, very emotional and beautiful and flowing, and I find his Serenade as representative of that extremely beautiful attribute.
In des Mondes Licht, denn
Fritz Wunderlich singing Schubert's Serenade. What about Magdi Yacoub on a desert island? Do you think you could organise yourself practically and domestically for this kind of Robinson Crusoe existence?
I'm not a very organised person when it comes to everyday life. I'm blessed with people who try and organise me.
But so otherwise you create chaos, do you?
Yeah, that's what worries me, yes.
But is there, again, contemplating a desert island existence, is there part of you that longs for that kind of peace, or are you hooked in many ways on the pressure of your work?
No, I think I am hooked on my work to some extent, but I still long for the idea of being on my own, interacting with nature. I think it doesn't frighten me somehow.
And what about in real life? You're 60 later this year. Do you contemplate retirement?
I don't think about it. I still am totally immersed in my work. But there are things in life I would want to do.
What do you want to do?
I want to farm, for example, or grow flowers. That would be something which could absorb me very much.
You grow orchids, don't you?
I do, yeah.
Award-winning orchids?
Well, I don't know. I haven't entered competitions, but some of the flowers could be. But I haven't been that competitive, if you like, in that field.
By the way, did your father live to see you fulfil your ambition?
No, my father died just before I came to this country. He had a heart attack and died. That was quite sad.
Last record.
The last record is Mozart's Fantasia for piano. Mozart has many facets, as we have heard, but at times he can be very thoughtful. And I think that in the Fantasia, he just shows that very nicely.
Part of Mozart's Fantasia for piano in D minor, played by Emil Gilels. If you could only take one of those records, Professor.
I think it's going to be very difficult to choose, but I think I'll take the Mozart's Fantasia.
What about your book?
I think I'll take a book by the late Sir Peter Medawar, Pluto's Republic. And in that book, he starts by saying that one of his friends came to him and said, I understand you're a philosopher. Don't you think that Pluto's Republic is a wonderful thing? What he meant, of course, was Plato's Republic, and he got it all wrong, mistaking the philosopher with Pluto, who is from the Greek mythology, the god of the underworld and death. And Peter Medawar thought that was really apt, because there must be a Plutus Republic for the intellectual underworld, and that this has many citizens. And then he starts telling you in a very humorous fashion, and critical of course, about the citizens of Plutus Republic.
What about your luxury?
I think I'll take a hammock to listen to my music or read the books. That would be my luxury.
Professor Sir Magdi Yacoub, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.